A fairly new field in science says doing everything you can to live a healthy life should probably include working to improve the health of the planet.
Planetary health and human health go hand in hand.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, a conversation about protecting and studying planetary health. We'll also spend an academic minute using Mother Nature as a workout partner. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Protect the health of the planet, and you protect your own health. That there is an extremely boiled-down version of the new book called Planetary Health, Protecting Nature to Protect Ourselves. The emerging field of planetary health connects the dots between changes in Earth's environment and the general well-being of us humans wandering around the planet. One of the co-editors of the book is Dr. Samuel Myers. Sam Myers is director of the Planetary Health Alliance and a principal research scientist at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. I asked why he and his co-editor, Dr. Howard Frumkin, took on this project.
Well, because this is a very rapidly emerging interdisciplinary field that's only been out for, about 5 years in kind of the public domain after the release of a big Lancet Commission report in 2015. And the field's been growing really, really fast with new journals and new degree programs and courses and professorships and a lot of new programs in the UN system. And yet there's no sort of central text to really help to define the field. And so I've been approached by a bunch of different publishers and sort of was dreading the project, to be perfectly honest, because it's a lot of work and I already have a lot of work, but it seemed like a really, really important thing to kind of lay out a vision for this field as it's really taking shape in front of us.
What is the difference between investigating planetary health and what we've been calling all these years environmentalism?
Well, it's really different, actually. And it really comes from the recognition that we've reached sort of a unique moment in human history where the scale of human impacts on our natural systems, not just the climate system, but biodiversity and land use and pollution of air, water, and soil, and all the ways that we're transforming the natural environment, that those transformations are coming back to impact our own health and well-being. And so maintaining and protecting our natural systems has become a matter of urgent self-interest. And so it's a moment in which the distinction between thinking about nature and environmentalism and protecting nature and thinking about how to take care of human health and well-being and sort of safeguarding global health have suddenly sort of come into focus as being two sides of the same coin, and they're no longer really distinct entities. So it's not so much about environmentalism, and I wouldn't really define myself as an environmentalist. I'd define myself as a humanist who's concerned about the future of humanity and human well-being, but that future is in jeopardy if the biological systems that we depend on are crumbling underneath us.
Can you separate planetary health from human health, or are they just going to be intertwined forever?
Well, I think that's actually sort of the fundamental point, is that planetary health and human health go hand in hand, and that for, much of human history, that hasn't been the case. We've been able to engage in practices that degrade the natural environment sort of in service of economic growth and development, but that disconnect is fast becoming impossible because the scale of impacts on natural systems means that core life support systems are starting to crumble underneath us. So the term planetary health really holds the meaning of both human health and the health of our natural systems.
What seems to be at risk the most? I mean, we see food production is up probably more than it ever has been. Can that last?
Well, we have a whole chapter in our book, and it's about food and food systems and human health, one of the chapters that I wrote. And we actually have a sort of fascinating, what I call a triple challenge, where in order to keep up with food demand over the next 50 years, we're going to have to maintain those increases in food production that you're talking about at really historic rates for the next 50 years. We need to almost double global food production to keep up with demand. At the same time, we're recognizing that there are a lot of environmental headwinds to doing that. So climate change, water scarcity, land degradation, air and soil pollution, loss of pollinating insects and other changes in biodiversity all actually create headwinds for our ability to produce enough food. And then the third problem is that the food production system itself is probably the single biggest driver of environmental transformation. So it's the biggest driver of biodiversity loss and land use change. It's a major driver of pollution of water and soil and a major contributor to climate change. And so somehow we need to increase food production while reducing the ecological footprint of the food production system and do all of that in the context of these headwinds. And in many ways, I actually believe that we can do that. There are a lot of solutions and there are a lot of opportunities and there's a lot of transformation going on in the food system right now, but it requires taking notice and taking that challenge really seriously.
Can this be done without looking at population control first?
Well, I think that, you know, we also have a chapter about population and consumption, and the authors make a lovely point, which is that there's for many decades, there's been an argument about whether the issue is really population or our consumption practices. And certainly there are segments of the global population that consume much, much, much larger amounts than others. And so, you know, for those of us in the wealthy parts of the global north to say, you know, it's a population problem in the global south is sort of disingenuous because our consumption is quite outsized. But the point that the authors make is that the argument about whether it's population or consumption is sort of like arguing whether the area of a rectangle is determined by the length or the width, right? It's obviously the one times the other. And so thinking about how to address human population is an important part of the planetary health conversation. I don't like the term population control. It sort of goes back to the 60s and 70s when there was a lot of coercion involved, forced sterilizations and things like that. But what I do think we should all be able to get behind is the need for education of girls, providing economic opportunities for women, and providing access to family planning for couples who want it. And each one of those things is a clear good in its own right, and yet taken together, those things would do an enormous amount to help reduce the growth of the human population.
Do rich nations in the world need to overcompensate for the poorer nations? Do they need to do more than their part to make up for countries that might not be able to afford it?
Well, when you look at the scale of the problem that we face, they've already overcompensated in terms of producing the problems. So that's a little bit of an unfair framing, I think, if you're sitting in the global south. Like, hey, you guys are the ones that really drove climate change and have been mostly responsible for biodiversity loss and a lot of the pollution problems that we face. I think based on the fact that we've been responsible for generating these problems in disproportionate ways, and that the people who will bear the largest burden of global environmental change tend to be the poorest people in the world and future generations. I think that there is a moral dimension to this that requires that the wealthiest people in the world are willing to take leadership in trying to get us on a different trajectory and start to solve these problems.
One thing I took from this is it's not can we solve these problems, but will we solve these problems? Is there a will to do this?
Well, it's a great distinction. And, you know, when we set out to write this book 3 years ago, and I co-edited it with my colleague, Howie Frumkin, I thought that the question that we were trying to answer in some ways was, can we address the scale of our transformation of nature and the extent to which it's really threatening every dimension of human health and well-being? How do we solve this problem? And the whole half of the book is really about this very rich terrain of solutions across just about every dimension of human life, food systems, energy systems, manufacturing, chemistry, et cetera. But as we explored those solutions, and it became clear that in many instances, we know a lot about what to do, it started to become clear to me that the question wasn't can we, but will we? Do we have the political will to insist on, you know, enlightened governance, on a policy environment that helps businesses to do the right thing, on holding those businesses accountable, on taking collective action and movement building? And I think, you know, this is the great drama of this moment is will we? And, you know, if you look at the federal leadership in our country right now, the answer is no, we don't have political will coming from our national leadership. But if you start to look at citizens groups and municipalities and cities, there's all kinds of will being sort of emerging from those different dimensions. So I guess we'll find out over the next several years.
One of the questions I have here in capital letters is how do you separate the science from the politics in getting this done?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's a question that has come into sharp focus in the last 4 years. It never used to be that there was such a divide between the science and the politics, or that you could have a major sort of political platform in this country that was really about rejecting science sort of across the board. So I'm hoping that that's sort of an aberration and that we can get back to a place where all Americans are ready to acknowledge that science and certain kinds of expertise are relevant in trying to solve these big societal challenges we face. And hopefully we'll start to get there, because if we renounce the science, as we've learned with this COVID pandemic, the consequences are pretty serious, and you know, lives are lost, and generations will suffer. So hopefully we can get past that and back to a slightly more sort of practical way of tackling the problems that we face.
Still to come, our conversation with Dr. Sam Myers continues with a look at how the COVID-19 pandemic could be considered a prototypical planetary health story. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and our guest today is Dr. Sam Myers, director of the Planetary Health Alliance and a principal research scientist at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. We're talking about his new book called Planetary Health, Protecting Nature to Protect Ourselves. Now, the book was completed before COVID-19 came into our lives, but he does call the pandemic a prototypical planetary health story. I asked if Earth was trying to tell us something with this disease.
Well, I don't know whether Earth is trying to tell us something, but I do think that it is a pretty prototypical story in a variety of ways. The first way is just the emergence of the pandemic itself, which really kind of is the latest in a series of alarm bells that have been ringing across the world about our sort of broken relationship with nature, and whether we're looking at the hurricane season 2 years ago that wiped out Caribbean nations, or this hurricane season that's been hammering the Gulf Coast, or the West Coast on fire, or Siberia, or the Pantanal in Brazil on fire, or 50 million acres burned in Australia, or the worst locust outbreak in 70 years in East Africa. You know, over and over, we're seeing the same story, and it's all of these events have human fingerprints all over them. And so, in this case, the pandemic really emerged from a relationship between human beings and wildlife populations that's very problematic, and holding many, many different species in close proximity in these wild animal markets near human populations. We've known that is a very risky practice for decades. It's been warned that we'll see more and more zoonotic diseases emerge from that. And so this is one of those sort of unsurprising surprises. It's something that we anticipated. And there are many other ways that we're interacting with wildlife populations that are also risky: incursions into their habitat for logging and mining and agriculture and bushmeat hunting. But more broadly, there are other lessons we've been learning. I mean, one is that massive, rapid, concerted, collective behavior change across the planet is possible, which is sort of fascinating. It's not something we've ever seen before, but in the last 6 months, that's what we have seen, and that's actually very encouraging, that we're capable of changing the way we live in response to a threat, and that's part of what we need to do to address planetary health. We've also seen that nature regenerates, and that when we stop trashing it, air quality starts to improve, water quality gets better, wildlife moves back into places where it didn't used to be. We've learned that nature is a solace, and that all of us are going outside to find each other and to support our mental health. And we're using our parks and our public lands in ways that we've never used in these numbers in response to this pandemic as well. And finally, that we have this sort of very practical opportunity in our response to the pandemic. We're going to be spending trillions of dollars here and in other countries to stimulate our economies after this sort of horror of the economic response to COVID. And we have an opportunity to spend that money to, as the UN's been saying, to build back better, to actually be supporting the development of the infrastructure we need to learn to live differently on the planet and take better care of our natural systems. And so there's a huge opportunity in how we respond to the pandemic.
Do you see, and I'm trying to find a really intelligent way to frame this question, and it's not coming to me, so I'm just going to ask it flat out. Is it better or worse for humanity to live put together in cities or to spread out and live in the country?
Well, the reason it's not an easy question to ask is because it depends so much. You know, there are ways that we can live in cities where we spread ourselves out in massive sprawl and pay homage to, the automobile, and never see each other in, our neighborhoods, and spend hours in traffic. And clearly, that way of living in great big houses with fenced off yards, driving for hours to commute, is not particularly great for us in terms of our mental or physical health, and not particularly good for the planet. But there are other ways of living in cities that are terrific from both the mental and physical health standpoint and in terms of our ecological footprint. And so the chapter that we have on cities and urban design really emphasizes that at each scale, whether you're talking about buildings themselves or whether you're talking about collections of buildings and neighborhoods, or whether you're talking about whole municipalities or even the surrounding areas around cities, that there are huge opportunities for designing those cities to optimize mental and physical health and to minimize the total ecological footprint of the inhabitants, so that we're building out of better materials, we're building very efficient buildings, we're creating green buildings, we're having rooftop gardens that bring people together and provide social connectedness and improve mental health. We're designing cities around walking and biking, which improves exercise and is good for us, but it's also good for air quality and for addressing climate change. We're managing our wastes in ways that recycle and provide better access to fresh water and fertilizer and recapture energy. And so really across the board, when you look at cities, they're just a really fascinating, complicated ecosystem where there are enormous opportunities for improving the efficiency with which we live, as well as improving our own health and well-being. And there's a lot of creative thinking going into that right now.
And that sounds great in the day when we're able to stand within 6 feet of each other. So we'll wait for that.
Exactly.
One other thing I'd like to ask you about is energy production. We hear so much about renewables and how we're moving to renewables. Is renewable energy really doable? Is it all upside?
Well, nothing is all upside, I don't think, or at least I haven't encountered it yet. But yes, moving to renewables is extraordinarily important. And yes, it holds a promise to dramatically improve the challenge of climate change as well as human health. And this is sort of a recurring theme in planetary health, is that all across that sort of rich terrain of solutions I was talking about are these co-benefits, these opportunities to not only address the ecological problem, but at the same time to improve our own health or our economic opportunities in the process. And so, for example, around 7 to 8 million people a year are dying as a result of both indoor and outdoor air pollution. And almost all of that is from combustion of fossil fuels or biomass. And so if we move toward renewable energy where we electrified homes and we were using wind or solar or hydro energy, we would actually completely address that air quality problem and save enormous numbers of lives while also completely removing the carbon associated with fossil fuel combustion and its impacts on our climate system. And so certainly around the edges, there are issues. I mean, each one of these technologies requires mining materials and producing, whether it's wind turbines or solar panels, and clearly there are ecological footprints to that. But compared to our current system of fossil fuel combustion, they're just dramatically better from the standpoint of health, and they're completely better from the standpoint of climate change.
Well, there's certainly a tremendous amount of research and information in this book. It's not exactly a happy, fun book. Is there any good news in the end? Are you hopeful?
Yeah, I would dispute that characterization. So I think that, you know, our whole goal in writing this book was to be hopeful. And, you know, it's true that there's a diagnosis to make. And when the doctor tells you, hey, I'm sorry, you've got cancer, it's not fair to say, hey, doc, you know, that's kind of a downer. Like, the news is the news. And the fact is that we are in an urgent situation where our current trajectory is problematic and we need to fix it. But the whole second half of our book is about solutions. And there really is an enormous amount that can be done to get on a different trajectory. And the last chapter is a story that I think is awfully important for us to hold in our hearts, which is this aspirational vision of what a bright future could look like. And I think there's every reason to believe that, you know, 100 years from now, our grandchildren could live in a world where every parameter of human development, whether it's health or education or wealth or gender equity or racial equity, is looking better than it's ever looked in the history of the human species. And at the same time, we've decarbonized our energy economy and we're no longer changing the climate, and have developed food systems that are dramatically more efficient. We're manufacturing goods in a way that really embraces a circular economy and is much more efficient. And where with every passing decade, there's actually more breathing room for the rest of the biosphere. And what a wonderful world that would be to live in for our grandchildren. So it's certainly a plausible future. The point is that it all comes down to what we do right now You know, it's about this generation over the next 30 years and the choices that we make on whether we seize that future, and this is the political will problem, whether we seize that future and initiate the kinds of transformative changes that we need, or whether we continue on down the road that's taking us somewhere we really don't want to go.
Again, the name of Dr. Sam Meyer's new book is Planetary Health, Protecting Nature to Protect Ourselves. His co-editor is Dr. Howard Frumkin. It's published by Island Press. Not surprisingly, the more you are active in the great outdoors, the more you become concerned about climate change. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Changing attitudes toward global warming is hard. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, George Cunningham, professor of graduate and professional studies, details one surprising way to do so.
Being active has a number of benefits, including better fitness and cognitive functioning, a reduction of various diseases, and improved physical and mental health. Our recent research also points to another outcome of being active, climate change attitudes. Though there are certainly exceptions, most physical activity takes place outdoors. As a result, exercisers are able to enjoy nature and become more connected with their surroundings. If this is the case, exercisers might be especially aware of the ways in which climate change could hinder their ability to be active. When they arrive at this conclusion, they might also advocate for new laws and policies that would serve to protect the environment. To examine these possibilities, we analyzed data from over 3,100 counties across the U.S. In addition to collecting data related to physical activity and climate change attitudes, we accounted for other factors that might impact the results. These included the county residents' access to physical activity, demographics, education, and voting patterns in the 2016 presidential election. After accounting for these factors, we found that as physical activity increased, so too did county residents' conviction that climate change personally impacted them. Personal harm beliefs were then related to their preference for stronger climate change policies. Based on these findings, we concluded that activists, scientists, and policymakers looking to shape public opinion around climate change should consider the sport and physical activity domain.
That was George Cunningham of Texas A&M University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org, and you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.
Thank you.